I'll call this hearing of the Agriculture and Rural Development Finance Committee to order. Quorum is present. Members, we have before us the minutes of the March 9th meeting. Representative Heidgerken moves the approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Now we'll proceed to vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the amendments are adopted. We have three bills before us today. I'll be turning the gavel over to the committee's vice chair, Representative Pennis, and call upon the witnesses for the House. I'd like to move House File 2755, the Grain Buyers Bonds bill.
Representative Harders.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're going
to set it up there. House file. Wait a minute. I better get my paperwork together here. I'm on county fairs right now. House file 2755. It was brought to me by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. This is statute pertaining to grain buyers' bonds. And the department recommends an update due to the times having changed and dollars having changed over those years. I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Gruniski from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Sir, could I ask you to walk us through the bill?
My name is Jim Gruniski. I'm Assistant Director of the Minnesota Ag Certification Section of the Ag Marketing Services Division of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. This House File 2755 amends the amounts of the grain buyers' bonds that would be required of grain buyers. The department determines the amount of bonding a grain buyer is required to have by the amount of grain they purchased in the previous calendar year. This bill would add three levels to the existing amount of the bonds that the current statute has. We would redefine the amount of grain purchased that requires a $50,000 bond, changing that from more than $3 million to $3 million to not more than $6 million. We'd add a layer of $70,000 bonding for purchases between $6 million and $12 million. There would be an additional bond amount of $125,000 for grain purchases from $12 million to $24 million. And then from there'd be a maximum bond of $150,000 for grain buyers who purchase in excess of $24 million worth of grain. And the rest of the bill defines when the new bonds would take effect, and that pretty much defines what we're trying to do at this point.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members? I have a couple questions. Would this bonding that you're talking about cover storage of grain?
Madam Chair, no, it would not.
Okay. And currently the bonding is at $50,000. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then could you give the committee an idea about average cost for a type of bond? Let's say, how much is it per thousand on an average for a bond?
I'm sure the average cost of a bond is $10 per thousand. I've talked with some insurance industry members, and they're not sure if the rate would change, but they weren't, they couldn't assure me that it would be any different.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, I have another witness.
Okay.
If there are no further questions for the department, I have someone from the industry affected by this language, Mr. Bob Zelenka.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Zelenka. Identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Our association represents the grain elevators and feed mills here in the state of Minnesota. We would be in support of the bill as presented. We believe also that the legislation and the statute that exists does allow the commissioner to exceed the amounts listed. These are minimums listed in this. I would suggest to the department that they consider on the lower end, the 10, 20, and 30,000 level, the commissioner consider maybe taking another look at those amounts in light of what's transpired lately in one portion of the state. But in terms of the bill itself, though, we would certainly support the bill. I think that it would work from our standpoint. And in terms of the premium for a grain buyer bond, most grain elevators are at the maximum $50,000 bond currently. Most elevators would probably, on this scenario, fall into the $125,000 bond category. And that'd be an increase of about $750 premium to your average grain elevator. Cost of doing business, certainly something that is acceptable, and if we would certainly encourage the department to look at using the existing grain buyer legislation, and particularly in the extensions of credit section of that, to try to develop a more active role, if you will, in the enforcement of existing statute.
Mr. Zelenka, since you brought up that one incident probably precipitated this, even at $150,000, I understand that this is to cover approximately 2 days worth of grain sales. How effective do you think $150,000 would be on that case versus $50,000? I know it's $100,000 more, but considering that right now it's running over $2 million in costs.
Representative Pennis, I think what I think everyone needs to understand is that surety bonding is a screening process. It's not insurance. Right. So you're not setting aside money anticipating loss. When a surety company looks at an application and approves that application, they're assuming there will be no loss based on the net worth, working capital, and so on. I think in terms of the amount, the higher the bond amount, the harder a bonding company will look at an application in terms of their net worth, working capital, and so on. And once they meet that criteria, then they're allowed to be licensed by the state of Minnesota. The premium that is charged by surety, the $500, or it could be up to $1,250 for a $125,000 bond, merely goes to cover the administration by the surety of the process of issuing the bond. So, again, it's not insurance, and I think people need to understand that. I think there's a misunderstanding out there about what bonding really is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the explanation, because that is...
Madam Chair.
Sure. Yes.
That being said, I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer to my bill.
Yep.
The A1 amendment, and does raise on line page 2... on line 17, for a first-time applicant, raises the bond to $50,000, and pardon me, has language changing the financial statement being accompanied by a reviewed financial statement or audit, as opposed to a compilation report. The financial statement or audit requires verification by a third party.
Okay, you move...
So, Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment. Okay.
The A1 amendment has been moved. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, we have the A1 amendment on. Any Representative Harders, do you have any further comments on the amendment? Otherwise, are there any questions on the amendment? I seem to be the only one asking questions.
Chair, you do have a comment.
I do have a question and on the financial statement or audit. And before, from the line stricken, it says prepared by a grain commission firm or a management firm approved by the commissioner or by. And now we've taken out that language and we just have by an independent public accountant in accordance with. So what I'm seeing here, just looking at it right off, is that we've taken the grain commissioner out of the picture and we've said are going to go and get an independent public accountant and do the financial statement. Could I have a comment from you, Mr. Slinka, on that as far as costs and how our grain buyers and sellers will feel?
Madam Chair, the current practice in the industry, most of your grain buyers, grain warehouses, do already provide a minimum review statement. And some a full-blown audit. The compilation statement that's prepared, and I would support the amendment, I guess, from the standpoint of strengthening the grain buyer law by asking for a little bit more of a financial statement that has more integrity. A compilation, you're merely handing information to an accountant and he's putting it into a format. The commission firm, as you mentioned in there, what they're referring to is a commission firm is a company that buys and sells grain and takes a commission. And part of their service used to be providing financial statements for grain elevators. That's why it's mentioned in there. Commission firms have really stopped doing that. So at this point in time, a grain buyer or grain warehouse, you're having an accountant, a CPA accountant, do your books at a minimum review, allow you getting a full audit. So in terms of strengthening the bill, I would say this is a very positive point and it shouldn't be very disruptive from my perspective. And in terms of the bond increase to $50,000 for entry, I would support that as well because I think that would encourage a bonding company to take a more serious look at an applicant and hopefully if they meet the test, if you will, to get into the business, that's really what it's all about, making sure that people have financial integrity.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question was going to be very similar to yours, Madam Chair. The smallest bond amount, the $10,000 for up to $100,000 worth of grain buying, $100,000 worth of grain buying is not a lot of grain. And I'm wondering how many, and I don't know if we have an answer to that in this room, how many people do we have currently out there buying that would fit in this category? And actually, we could even include the up to $750,000 because that's, just did a quick calculation, you're talking about maybe 300,000 bushels of corn at $750,000 worth of it, and again, for that's relatively small, and I'm just wondering how many we have like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think we have about 27 grain buyers that are under $100,000. Many of those have a grain buyer's license not to buy grain, but to sell grain to terminals. Mm-hmm. They use it for that purpose. I can't tell you offhand how many are under $750,000, but I certainly can get that information to you.
Follow-up, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns I have, and this gets back to your question, Madam Chair, the requirement of a CPA audited or prepared financial statement, I think, for one of those smaller buyers may not be something they normally do. It could be a little more of a burden for them, and I'm wondering if they're aware of this and if there would be more. That's, 27 is a little more than I thought there might be, actually. And so I'm just wondering what the impact might be for some of those smaller ones and whether that's a bit onerous for them.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, I think what will probably happen is some of these people will not apply for a license if these requirements are there. Some of our fears are that some of these people will continue to buy grain without a license. So, we've been playing with this over the years, you know, how strict do you get? Do you drive people underground, or do you keep them licensed and have some sort of a bond with them, you know, with us, you know? So there are some, I think a lot of these incidental buyers, might call, will drop out of the system rather than comply.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, now it's starting to almost sound like we're trying to limit the club here a little bit and make sure the small guys stay out. Is there a problem that we're trying to address with this? I mean, Representative Harder started out by saying we're just updating some of the language, and now it sounds like we're trying to be a little more restrictive and maybe keep some of the smaller guys out. Is that an intent here? Is there a problem with some of the smaller buyers? Sounds like we might be decreasing competition a little bit, if that's the intent. And all, quite frankly, as we raise the bar for entry, I think you'd increase the possibility if there's people right now slipping underneath and trying to do it because they don't want to buy a bond. The bond price probably is not such a big deal. Going through a CPA audit on your books is probably a little bit more significant to cost. So I'm just wondering if we're trying to get at something like that here.
Comment?
Well, Mr. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Harder.
Representative Demmer, this comes as a suggestion from the industry, the amendment that was put on, and I'd certainly be glad to abide by the will of the committee, your wishes as to whether we stay at the $50,000 entry point. I believe Mr. Zelenka has some compelling information on the fact that we are talking about someone entering a business that is handling someone else's grain, and the public needs assurance, or the selling public needs assurance that this is a person worthy of being entrusted with contracting grain and so forth. And then after the first year of business activity, then the buyer will plug into the schedule we have in this bill. But if you'd like to hear from Mr. Zelenka again or have questions of him, I'd be glad to see him come back to the table.
Representative Demmer, would you like to hear more?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Harder, I don't know that the bond itself is such a big thing. You know, the $50,000 bond, I think you said it was a dollar per thousand.
$10.
$10 per thousand. You know, we're talking about $500. I don't know that that would be a barrier in and of itself. I'm more concerned with the reporting requirements and having to go through a CPA audit. Those can be quite expensive. That would be, I think that would dwarf that $500 bond cost, if I'm not mistaken. Now, again, I don't know, excuse me, Madam Chair, I don't know if we're trying to solve a problem that exists out there, if this is maybe an unintended consequence, I don't know. And maybe it's fine, and maybe it's not a big issue. I don't know. I just raised the question.
I'd like Mr. Zelenka to address that issue.
Representative, this bill was discussed prior to a situation that occurred up in the Red River Valley, but we do have a situation in the valley where we have a $3 million loss pending from a truck grain buy dinner and train truck grain buyer. And when situations like that occur, it reflects poorly on the whole industry. All 600 grain elevators in the state, all 400, all the independent grain buyers that are out there as well. We feel that in looking at this legislation, that there should be some minimum requirements for people to get involved in this business that I think the general public, our producer customers, expect. When you say you're bonded and licensed and you're buying grain in the country, there's a perception that somebody did a lot of homework and this guy is good, and those kind of perceptions are out there. Yet when you look at a compilation statement, for example, being submitted, numbers that are just given to somebody and not verified, we feel that the difference of $1,000 to prepare a compilation report or $2,000 to do a review statement, that additional $1,000 investment is well worth it in terms of the security that I think producers would feel and I think the department would have in terms of licensing these individuals. So thus the support for looking at that. We're not looking at it as an impediment, but I think you do have to have some minimum standards that need to be met, and we are compelled right now to strengthen the grain buyer law because we're pressured right now because of what transpired in that situation to do something positive to strengthen this law. And I think the steps that are being taken here, that are being suggested, I think do that.
Thank you. Well, I do have a feeling that we are, in some ways, we are making it more difficult for the small grain buyer and seller, and the one that's the pig and, you know, takes, has done the damage in the case up in my area, probably wouldn't abide by this since he didn't abide by anything else. And I don't know if this is going to, you know, keep him in check more or not. But it is very well taken that the bond levels were low. And I think you could tell us how long. I think it's 19 years since you've changed them or something like that, since they've been raised. So that certainly would, certainly in time. Can I ask one more question, then I'm done? How do you ensure, and this probably is for the department, how do you ensure that that your grain buyers are licensed buyers and sellers?
Madam Chair, the division has a field staff of warehouse examiners. Primarily, they do audits of state-licensed grain storage elevators, but part of their duties are to do examinations at grain buyers and to investigate allegations that somebody's buying grain without a license. And so we have to go on tips as far as any allegations of buying grain without a license. We don't have the means to search many of these out ourselves, but we follow up. But when a person drops the license, we follow up personally. We send somebody to their residence or their place of business to see if they indeed have quit buying grain. We, as far as licensed companies go, we send staff around. They might go to a grain buyer once every 3 years. And so it's not as regularly as we'd like, but we don't have the means to do it more often.
Thank you. Representative Hargers, do you want this bill put on the general register, right to the floor now?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So our motion is to move the bill and as amended and put it on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The bill goes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. And now, Representative Harders, you have House Bill 2051. And you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 2051 be recommended to pass.
Yes.
And sent to the general register.
General register.
Okay.
The state of Minnesota authorizes the organization of county agricultural societies to operate county and regional fairs and to provide premiums for exhibitors at these educational events. We became succinctly aware of this program last year as we were dealing with budget shortfalls and had to use some creativity in assuring that county fairs would not suffer a loss of reimbursement of premiums. And this committee was integral in assuring that that funding mechanism for our county fairs was protected. And I can tell you that your action last year was appreciated by the many, many folks who invest their own personal volunteer time in operating county fairs in the counties of the state of Minnesota. And I think our action as we responded to that budgetary concern really demonstrated the recognition by this committee as county and regional fairs being an important part of life in Minnesota. That highlighting interest in the program that reimburses premiums to county fairs, however, called attention to the existing statute that provides for this program and for the operation of county fairs and their relationship as they report to the Department of Agriculture for reimbursement for premiums, their relationship to nearby or the municipality in which they're located, and how they report to their county authorizing body, and caused a review of the existing statute. And I have here with me today Mr. Jerry Schoenfeld, representing the County Agricultural Societies. And would you like to walk through the bill? Or?
Madam Chair, and would you like to add your amendment before we go through the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is an amendment that is the result of some fine-tuning of details as we brought together the Department of Agriculture and the representative of the County Agricultural Associations. We kind of fine-tuned it a bit more, and I'd like to move the amendment. I'm not sure, is it A1?
It's A1. And then also we have, I think, a little technical amendments on that, and so I will refer to Sam Rankin.
Madam Chair and Representative Harder and committee members, there are a couple of very small oral amendments that we should perhaps make to the A1 amendment. On the A1 amendment, page 1, line 20, after entitled, let's insert the two little words, two payments. Two payments under the provisions of this chapter. That would be one of the two I will suggest. The second one, again on the A1 amendment, is on page 2, and it's on line 18. And this was my mistake. We're going to correct here. The phrase we should have used is generally accepted accounting principles. I put practices when I was typing it, and so the word practices should be changed to principles.
Okay. First, let's all those in favor of the amendments, oral amendments to the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And then all in favor of the A1 amendment, adding it on to the House Bill 2051, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, now we have it in the order that you wanted. Is there any no's? There aren't any no's. We need to read. Thank you for that disruption. All right. Representative Harders, would you like
Madam
to cover your bill?
You can tell that we're under the watchful eye of a classroom teacher who's used to handling a rowdy crowd.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I was saying, we have representation here today of the County Agricultural Societies, and the amendment that we now have added to the bill, thank you, updates this as a result of the work that has been done between that organization and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, who has the responsibility of administering this program. And so Mr. Schoenfeld can... Would you share with us the information of the bill?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I'm representing the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs in Minnesota. As we go through the bill, I'll try to make it brief, but on the first page of the bill, there is stricken language on the bill originally, and the amendment reinstates that stricken language. The reason that it was originally stricken was because there are 96 agricultural societies in the state and there are only 87 counties. So when we first looked at the language, we thought, well, since it designates that only one can be organized in the county, that wasn't consistent with existing practice. However, the Department of Agriculture objected to that because of the fact that they said that organized was a moving forward into the future term, and so that they didn't want to see any more than 96 organized as such, but that, in fact, all 96 were grandfathered in under this. So we accepted that language change. If you go to page 3, I believe that's the next change. originally the annual membership of 25 or more. Some of the smaller fairs, quite frankly, are having a hard time keeping that many people on their boards, so they changed it to, we changed it to 15. Then we kind of came into the 21st century with allowing the publication and distribution of the premium fair list to be put onto the internet. Then when you go further down the page, line 33, we changed what kind of records and reporting had to be reported. Traditionally, and I guess if anybody wanted to see it, there was quite a laundry list of things, including parking fees and whether you rented it out for boats in the summer and all kinds of things that were on the old reporting mechanism. This whole situation is centered around premiums paid to money paid by the Department of Agriculture on premiums to the county fairs, and so it was streamlined and simply said it's submitted its annual report of premiums paid to the Commissioner of Agriculture rather than the long laundry list of things that were required under the old list. If you go to page 4, because things are changing and there's quite a laundry list towards the top of the page, like lines 6, 7, and 8, and so those kinds of things that qualified for premiums, you know, as things change, computer sciences and other kinds of things were added as new areas of competition, so because of that we added up products of a creative nature. The Department of Agriculture was concerned about the premium list not being extended too far into certain kinds of things, so on line 14 they added the words that were excluded. Payments of awards for horse races were excluded, but also for horse pulls, tractor pulls, demolition derbies, automobile or other racing and jackpot premiums. Keep this for the kids. Then on line 18 there was a change where the department recommended that that language be stricken relative to the voucher system, because that is not the common practice of the state anymore. They no longer give vouchers to the Department of Finance. Instead, evidently, they get checks cut directly through an allocation that they have at the Department of Agriculture. If you go down to line 30, just some cleanup language to say that those which are entitled by law to receive it shall receive it. If you go to page 5, it says at the annual meeting, and there was prescriptive language that dealt with whether it was the society's secretary or the society's treasurer that had to give a particular report. Because the bylaws are all different for each society, we simply changed that and said that it's so that it's as an officer of the society. And then the financial statements that were changed, so that it used to be that the financial statements and so forth were fairly prescriptive by the state, but with the invent of Quicken and other types of softwares where people are now using different types of softwares to keep track of the financial statements, that was changed so that they had a little more flexibility and simply said that they have to use generally accepted accounting principles in order to keep track of it, and that the report must list payments paid out for the premiums and other purposes. Then the reports, one additional thing that the department had requested to be added was that on that page, the reports of the society are public data under Chapter 13. We don't believe any fairs were trying to keep it away as non-public data, but it makes clear that it is public data and that any person can get a copy of the annual report from the society. Next change took place was down towards the bottom where it says that the agricultural society held within corporate limits of the city or in close proximity to. Many fairs are on the outside of the city limits as such. They are right next to the city limits quite often, but not necessarily within them, so that change was made there. And what it did was lifted restrictions on the amount of money that the city could give to a fair if it was within or just in close proximity to, that it is local control in terms of their own decisions as to whether what amount of money they wanted to be able to give to a fair for its operation. On the next page, page 6, the department had recommended that from lines approximately 16, I guess, down to about 35, that language be stricken because it wasn't necessarily consistent with what they were doing. It no longer would require the county auditor to file, to file with the county auditor or the Commissioner of Agriculture, but instead available to the public. Then there is language on section 6 on page 7 that provides, again, lifting of the what was viewed as an antiquated number restriction on the amount of money that should be given for sites and building sites by a local unit of government. And then on the last portion on Section 7, originally those class 1 and 2 cities were allowed to had some zoning restrictions during the fair that were lifted, and if it was good for class 1 and 2 cities, we felt that it was good for class 3 cities as well, so we lifted that in that particular case. And Madam Chair, I think that pretty much covers it, and we appreciate the work that Representative Harder and the Department of Agriculture put on with working with the societies, and appreciate the efforts of this particular committee and all of the effort you made during the last couple of years to help the fairs across the state, particularly with the reinstatement of the finances that were taken away or proposed to be taken away last year, and the effort of all of you on this committee to maintain this function. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you on behalf of the committee. Are there any questions? Okay, then I renew the motion that House File 2051, as amended, be passed and moved on to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. It passes. Okay, Representative Junkie, could you go to the front, please?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Junkie, I understand your bill is to go to the Higher Ed Committee.
I'd move House File 2272, Madam Chair, and recommend it to pass and be referred to Higher Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Representative Junkie. Your bill is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, I don't have to tell this committee the discussions that have been ongoing since last May and before on the County Extension Services. We've had a meeting, a joint meeting the other day with Higher Ed Finance, and certainly I know concerns from a lot of members were raised. As I looked at the problem and talked to people over the summer, I basically developed three different bills or approaches to what I thought would be a correction to what happened. The first bill, the other two bills that you don't see here, one of them is what I call the 60-40 bill. The actual last time that we had an official discussion with Extension on their plans and when they told us what they were going to do as they implemented their new vision for Extension, they indicated they would keep a county office and fund it at a 60-40%, with the state picking up 60% to the county's 40%. So I do have a bill drafted that's sitting out there that has that promise put down in writing. The second bill that I have out there was just simply an appropriation bill to appropriate money to the counties, $100,000 roughly each per county to add personnel. Obviously, we know there's a money problem this year, and that'll probably sit there until I can find, or the Senate can find, or anyone can find a pot of gold somewhere this year. But that's out there, too, as another concept. I know Senator Dill had a similar concept. Representative Ertl had a similar concept bill, too. So it's not anything unique. The last one, though, and the one you see before you, is House File 2272. Again, as we, as members, really had no input whatsoever into the Extension's new regional concept. It really was a top-down, top-down situation from Extension. That's been certainly talked about and discussed and passed on to university leadership. Most of us in here, I know I have talked to everyone from President Brunix on down to regents on down to deans of colleges and Dean Casey himself. And certainly over the summer we met. Representative Harder had a meeting out in the area. We had a meeting down here at the Capitol. And in all those meetings, we heard a number of themes. And the people, as well as the people we represent, but ourselves too, said we didn't have the input that we thought we should have for this. In fact, I've made, at that time, we had even made requests directly to President Brunix that this implementation, January implementation of this, be halted and waylaid a couple months so we could come to the legislature and have the discussion. But again, the decision was made not to do that, that they would forge on without any legislative approval or oversight or discussion of this. So that be the case, it leaves us with only one option, and that's to introduce legislation and to have the discussions here in a public forum as we best see fit. So that was the genesis of this bill, 2217. Basically what it does, members, as I looked at the statutes, I thought it was pretty clear that our University of Minnesota Extension Service had to be and must have a county presence. Everywhere that I read in the existing statutes, it talks about county extension work. And you can see on the bill, other than the new language, this is existing language. And everything in here is defined as county extension work. Apparently it wasn't clear enough to the university what county meant. So what this bill does is basically just directs a little better definition to what county means. And you see in line 9, county extension work means educational programs and services located in the county. Now, I thought that was pretty clear, but we're making it clearer. And certainly down on the bottom, when we talk about how the appropriations that we give should be spent, we certainly believe, and again, when you look through that line, the old language, money appropriated by the state to maintain and pay expenses of county extension work must be spent under the direction of the Director of Extension, who, acting with the county extension committee, shall, and then I add the new words because apparently it wasn't clear, maintain a county extension office in each county. So again, county is all over the statutes, but apparently somehow we've interpreted that, or they have, to mean a regional concept or a statewide concept or something else. I guess on behalf of my county and my county commissioners, who I've talked to on this, some of them, and some were involved with this and early on in the process, as well as the most important people are the citizens out there. And you've heard it here also in testimony previous this year. We had the dairy folks. Remember the dairy farmer from Manoman who was here and asked about his extension programs for dairy, basically non-existent on a county level anymore. And we've heard that over and over from people. Yes, we thank the counties for maintaining an office. The infrastructure is still there, thank goodness. That was our first worry, that there would be counties without infrastructure, but it is still there. So a big thank you to the counties. But the fact is, those county budgets, other than a handful of counties who actually increased their share of those budgets, basically every county across the state has decreased their budgets from anywhere from a few percent up to over 70% of what they put in last year. And that's how they got the counties to buy in. Well, you get the choice now. You can pick to have the services only you can afford or that you need. And you can, you know, because that's the only choice you have as counties, is what they were told. And so, of course, the counties, being under budget constraints themselves, bought in, because, as you can see, most counties did not put in the same amount of monies that they did last year. So anyway, members, I think the time has come to start moving a bill along. I don't know where I would have a whole lot of disagreement on this, other than obviously from the university who's in the room today. I'd certainly ask for your support and stand to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Junkie. Commend you for bringing this forward and for continuing to exhibit your concern for the counties and extension program. I know that many of us in this room share your concern. I was wondering, had you sought any legal opinion on the statute as far as related to the university and the counties?
Actually, Madam Chair, and I have not yet. I'm sure that we could have counsel upstairs, Mr. Rankin and his crew, actually give an opinion on what they thought the language meant and how it read. I will frankly tell you that, as you know, we're in a small town here in the legislature, and I actually heard through the halls of the Capitol last year, last summer, and other places that the university was aware of some of these deficient, or these the county being in there was problematic for them in the statutes. But and again, this is hearsay. I know they'll deny it, but it's hearsay only, so I'm qualifying that. That there was talk of coming back later after this was implemented and clean up the statutes, if you will, to reflect the program that was put in place. So again, take it for what it's worth. That's Capitol Hall hearsay that was repeated to me by a couple of different people over the summer.
You have some other folks to testify?
I don't, Madam Chair.
I'd like to call on Dean Charles. Oops, excuse me, we have a question. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and Representative Junkie. I think we all kind of, in spirit, agree with what you're trying to accomplish here. My concern is, if we're going to almost be counterproductive by saying we have to have an office in every county, is that going to increase the level of service in every county? Offering services in a county doesn't necessarily, to me, mean the same as having to have an office there. And by forcing, on a given budget, forcing them to have offices in places that may not be needed, in effect would be decreasing the amount of service they'd be able to actually have, because they're paying for a building and heat and lights and equipment that probably wouldn't be necessary if they were allowed to react to the needs of whatever was needed in that area.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good question, Representative Demmer. I don't see that. Again, they're welcome to keep the regional concept, bring more services out there. We'd applaud them to do that. We'd welcome them, put their regional people into our county offices. And the fact remains, some of our counties were actually spending more, because a lot of those county offices used to be in-kind donations that were given by counties. Now they're charging rents and lease and have to buy equipment and other things. So my sense is that there would be more service to the local people with the county office present. Doesn't preclude them. They don't have to close their regional offices. They can, in fact, that was, and you weren't here, Representative Demmer, but last time when Representative Harder and I and others had this discussion in Representative Ness's committee, that was their plan at one time, was to open a regional, conceptually open regional offices, house the regional people within the county offices, but keep a presence in each county office to that tune of that 60-40, with the caveat that that would indeed add services, because now you could put a specialized regional master gardener program person, for example, that might cover 10 counties, would be housed in one of the county offices but serve regionally. So it actually, their original plan did add services, but maintain that county office and maintain their presence and maintain some funding in it. And so I would argue that the way they had originally had it set up and presented to us with our input did do just that, and that's what this bill's trying to get back to.
Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to stay quiet because I'm tired, but I don't want to say anything I'll regret. But Representative Junkie, and I did that today actually already, so. Representative Junkie, I know you're incredibly passionate about this. I am as well, but my district is nothing like yours, okay? And so I don't have as clear a picture about how important, but I can tell it's important, the County Extension Services. And I just hope that we don't lose sight of the fact, last time Dean Casey was here, I asked him, some members had said, was this budget-driven or not? And they said, well, it was policy and some budget. And then after a while, and a lot of members left, I said, had the budget not changed drastically, would this have looked better? And Dean Casey said yes, and you can come correct me if I'm wrong. And so what I don't want to lose sight of here is that there is no such thing as a free lunch. And the way we approached the budget last session does have some unintended consequences. And I think the discussion we're having now is what we value as a state. And I think this is a treasure of our state, the County Extension Services. It's a real value to our citizens, especially to certain communities that might have, different economies and things. And I hope that we recognize that, because I don't know that the U of M implemented exactly what they had hoped to had the budget been maintained, but it was not.
Madam Chair and Representative Otto, I do agree that a lot of it was budget-driven. A lot of it was choices, though, also that the university made. They're a large institution that we give a lot of money to, and we've given a lot of money over the years, and they made this decision to do this. And they've done this in the past, too. Previous to your tenure here, they've done some things that have rocked the boat, so to say, with the Agriculture Committee in particular. But if you are concerned, I'm certainly willing to talk as this moves. And in fact, one of the things that came to mind is we certainly could put the county offices are there, the county budgets are set, the regional offices are running. We can certainly put an implementation date on this that's down the road to get us to the next budget session, too, when we will have the opportunity to redo budgets. And that's our problem this year with the budgets, obviously. But we could implement this, June 1st of 2005, after our budget appropriation year, and see if we can't correct some of that. But I'm certainly willing to work with that along the way, too.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to remind Representative Otto again from the last meeting that President Brunix in Lamberton did say that the budget was not primarily the reason for the regionalization of the extension service, that the budget may have accelerated a plan that was already in effect, but it was not the primary reason.
Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's correct, Representative Erdahl. What I did was I asked a further clarifying question, a further probing question, that the regional plans were in effect, they were accelerated due to the budget, but I asked a further question, which was, had the budget not been cut, would this regional plan look a little bit different, and would it have been able to serve folks better? And the answer was yes. So my point is that it was happening, but it was going to look a little different than what we ended up with. And that's just my point.
Dean Charles Casey, the Minnesota Extension Service. Welcome to the committee, Dean Casey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll just make a very brief statement, because I know your time is valuable. I am opposed to Representative Junkie's bill. My perspective, this is a major policy change. While state resources have been used to pay for a portion of educator salary and fringe cost, to my knowledge and research that I've looked at, state resources have never been used to maintain a county extension office. And I think, as he's indicated already, we work with county extension committees. They develop a budget. They propose to the county commissioners, and then they determine how many county dollars that they're going to use to maintain, support, and pay expenses for county extension work. So with that, I would respond to any questions, if you may have any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dean Casey, somewhat related to my question earlier to Representative Junkie, what would be your, based on the budget you have today, and we can assume that you'd get more or less money, but based on what you have today, if this were to become law and you had to have an office in every county, what would be your interpretation of the types of services and the way the services would look compared to what they are now with your new regional concept?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, in some ways it's a difficult question to answer, because probably the language that here is fairly general in terms of what it costs to maintain an office. So we have a large amount of our state dollars go to support our extension faculty on campus who generate the new knowledge and extend that knowledge to people at the local level. So if there's some trade-off between having people at the local level and losing some of our campus research base in the long term, we don't have the knowledge generation capability. So trying to keep those two in balance, as we think we have a pretty good balance right now, because the amount of money that we spend at our campus research base faculty and the people at the local level and the regional centers and some of those county-based individuals is pretty good right now. So concerned about whether we would, the balance could go and we could possibly lose some of the research-based faculty that we have.
Representative Junkie.
Just to respond, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to change the bill as it moves along, too, to make sure that maintain a county office is implied to mean at no higher level than, say, a 2003 budget year when they last were in there, and no greater split than a 60-40, which was their agreement. So I would certainly be willing to set some parameters on that so that they're not maintaining 100% the county office. I think it was a good partnership that we had with the counties, and I'd be happy to clarify that as it goes along if that's the only problem with this bill.
Well, Representative Junkie, I was a little distracted as to who was going to speak next because I was concentrating on this paragraph and focusing on the part where it says, acting with the county extension committee shall maintain a county extension office in each county. I think that's also reflective of what has been the traditional arrangement.
That's true.
Representative Erdahl. Did you want to speak?
Kind of
comfortable there.
No, ma'am, I hadn't indicated that I wanted to speak, although it's good to see Dr. Casey again. I've come to see you more than I do my wife lately.
It's hard to be a dean. It's hard to be a dean, and he's
not here. Any other questions of Dean Casey? Thank you, Dean Casey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Oh, pardon me. Representative Magnus.
One question I have, Madam Chair, to the presenters is, do we have a county extension office in each county currently?
Madam Chair, I believe each county did maintain an office of some sort. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, that is correct. Every county currently has a county extension office. It is a little unique in Cook County, but otherwise all counties do have a county extension office.
Okay. Representative
Madam
Magnus.
Chair, and I have the question relates to subdivision 2 when we're talking about basically agriculture, some nutrition things, youth 4-H programs and so on, and it I guess I don't have an understanding of what, for an example, the county extension office in Hennepin County or Ramsey County, how do they fulfill this role currently? What are they doing to carry out the definition of the roles they need to do in Subdivision 2 currently?
Dean Casey.
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, you're referring to the definition of county extension work?
Yes.
Well, Ramsey or Hennepin County has a large youth program, a large 4-H program. They have a large nutrition education program, which is part of a federal grant. There are agriculture. There are farmers in Hennepin County, which we serve, do a lot of environmental work, a lot of water quality work. We have some individuals that do some of that in Hennepin County. So we do meet that definition in Hennepin County. So a little bit what Representative Junkie said is when we went to counties for 2004 and said, with your resources, you can designate those resources to meet the highest priorities for extension work in your counties. And so counties are making those choices and identifying their priorities.
Representative Magnus.
Yes, in a follow-up, and again, I look at this as kind of a typical, I still got a cartoon on my wall in my office at home that says two guys are coming out to the farmer, Representative Junkie, and saying, we're from the government, we're here to help you, my friend. And this looked like one of those bills. We're from the government, we're here to help you. Regardless of what you want, regardless of what your needs are, regardless of what the future holds, we're going to go back to the good old days because we're from the government and we know what's best for you. So that's my apprehension with this.
And Madam Chair, just to respond, good points, Representative Magnus, and those words and what their dictate is has been monkeyed with in the past by us. Representative Harder and the committee minister, remember we did that. There were bills in Representative Ness's committee at the time because we thought there was too much, and we narrowed it more into the agriculture and the other fields at the time. So whenever I think county extension change, I think of Hank Kimball on Green Acres. That's what I think of. So you think of your cartoon, and I think of Hank Kimball on, with the Jeep.
You know,
Representative.
And Madam Chair, again, this is a feel-good bill, I'm sure. It makes us all feel good out in the country that, you know, the extension is, leaving us, and they abandoned us out here in the rural area, and by golly, we're going to keep them out there regardless of what the rules are. And I would really encourage us to look at things that fill the needs of the area. And maybe this does. Maybe this bill does. But,
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Just to your point, Representative Magnus, that's why you work with the County Extension Committee. And they're the ones that make the recommendations on what that office needs. Unfortunately, they didn't make the recommendation for the university to pull out of those offices and completely no longer financially support. And so all our county offices are diminished. I mean, we've got a part-time ag guy in Candiota County that we share, as most of them do now, from a full-time ag person. And that was downsized 3 or 4 years ago. We used to have a couple ag people. We'd have an ag specialist in some field. And so, I mean, we've been, I'm the fourth highest production county in the state in Candiota County. And I think we have a 1/4 or 1/5 ag person now in my county. So, again, it's become so diluted. We do have 1 4-H person. And, again, that's down. We'll see how that goes this year. Certainly we're going to depend more on volunteers and other things for 4-H because, as we all know, when we got to the summer, the 3 or 4 people in the office basically all devoted their time to 4-H as we got to fair time and other things. And now we've diluted that pool, too, so we're going to probably have one person trying to coordinate all this 4-H activity over fair time. And it's very difficult for the personnel that are left out there, put it that way. They've been struggling to hang on to their jobs, to get contracts out there. And again, I'm certainly willing for suggestions on this as it moves ahead, Representative Magnus. And I've already written the notes down about implementation dates of maybe July 2005 or January of 2006, if that fits the county budgeting better, so we can get through a budget cycle, they can, and we can revisit. But again, this really just defines that we do think the university, when it meant county, I guess I took the statutes at that face value. And if they really wanted to change that, they ought to have come to us, Representative Magnus and committee members, and had the talk about it and had the public input. Even the statewide citizens committee for extension, who should have had that input, did not either. They found out about this after the fact, after talking to committee members there. So, again, we just didn't have the input, and I think that's the point. And we asked them, please delay your implementation 2-3 months. We could have been sitting here right now. Maybe we'd have even agreed with what they did. I don't know, because we didn't have the opportunity to do that. And that's what this bill is all about, is reminding our good and fine university where I graduated from that it's still a citizens' university. It's our university, University of Minnesota. It belongs to Minnesota citizens. We put an awful lot of money into it, and I think we should have had some input.
Dr. Casey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to remind committee members that county extension committees are alive and well out there. We are meeting with county extension committees. Needs assessment will be done in conjunction with county extension committees. We will work with other partners out there in terms of needs assessment. So I also want to remind you that our regional educators are delivering programs in communities all over the state as we speak right now. So programs are being delivered at the local level. That was our intention. That's what's happening. And the other point is, I think one of the things that we are forgetting is that counties came to us and said, we are very concerned about our ability to fund extension in 2004. And we had a lot of concern whether some counties were going to close their office and not put any dollars into extension at the local level. So we really believe that this plan maintained those offices, again, as I say, in 86 out of 87 counties. And I recognize Representative Junkie's statement. They are not like they were before, but they are there. They are answering questions. People can come into the county offices. So we put together a plan in conjunction with the counties to meet citizen needs. And we're still working with those county extension committees to identify what are the most important programs that you want in your communities.
Dr. Casey, I can't resist asking the question about the clustering arrangement that had been implemented not too many years before the regionalization took place. Mm-hmm. In my estimation, there was a structure in place already that the counties were accustomed to that could have been enhanced or cut or modified and still maintain the specialization of agents, as Representative Junkie made reference to, and done the team thing, sharing across county lines regionally.
Madam Chair, we've had this discussion before, as you know. A number of things, as we've talked about. Because there were differences in how counties funded that 60-40 share that Representative Junkie refers to, some counties' share was 25% of the average salary of an educator. Some counties' share was 45% of the average salary of an educator. Some counties had more educators in their offices, and they were saying, why are we paying all of the office support costs for someone who is working in another county? Why are we paying all of the travel costs for someone who is working in a multi-county area? So we had some real challenges in working with counties of how we were going to reconcile those. We worked with the Association Minnesota County Extension Committee. We came up with 9 different options and basically stayed with the same one that we had. That was, again, there were some inequities in that we were really having a hard time addressing.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Feels like we've beat this up pretty good. I'm kind of conflicted here. I'm having a feeling that we're coming up to something where we're all agreeing on the same thing. We all want to provide these services. I think we're getting back to how we're going to do this. This bill talks about having an office in every county. Representative Junkie, you were just talking about what's in the offices in every county, and I think we've already established that all the counties now have offices. Therefore, this doesn't really accomplish too much other than having us make it look like we're either voting for or against extension when that's really not the case. I like your idea of a delayed implementation, but I guess what I would like to see is we have offices in each county now, and I think we're going to have that for this coming year unless something drastic happens that's outside of our control. How about if we take a look at this in a year and have everybody come back to the table, the university, we can bring extension people back in from out in our areas and get a report on how things are working as they are. Then we can look at the content of the offices, have input from the U.S., what we've seen, input from our residents, from our constituents, input from the people working out in the regions, and we can have a hearing, if you will, maybe in policy or here, it doesn't matter, to say, how's it going? We have offices in every county. We're into a new year. We've got a new year coming up. Say we do this a year from now or 2 years from now. We have another year coming up. Are we looking at closing some offices or whatever? I'm not sure what we're accomplishing here. I think we all have the same goals. I don't think there's any question about that. How would you feel about that, Representative Junkie, if we either change it or come with some sort of language that says, we understand that there's issues. This has been a big change. We need everybody at the table to look at this after it's been going on for a little while.
Representative Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair, two points. Number one, by a delayed implementation date, it certainly does that. The chairs have the opportunity next year to do exactly what you said as we talk about the implementation date and the funding thereof of these county offices. So I think it does, if I would add that language, and I'd be happy to add other comfort language if you want on that. But certainly that's my goal, is to get people in here and have a public discussion on it, not just a discussion with extension directives coming down from the top, but rather a grassroots from the bottom up, similar to what we saw done in Iowa. Frankly, if any of you followed the Iowa situation, they knew they had budget problems in Iowa a couple of years ago, too. It was no mystery. All states were having budget problems. They directed their statewide citizens committee in Iowa to go around, spend a year or a year and a half soliciting input, taking testimony, talking to people in every county, talking to people around the state, finding out what they want to see their extension service be, and then they basically implemented that plan, which is exactly, Representative Demmer, what I would have suggested they had done too had we been consulted on it. But we were not, and here we sit today in this quandary. So, yes, I would. And I would love to. I'd write up a bill, and we're going to meet. A lot of you got invitations with the statewide committee has a meeting, actually, in this, I believe, down in the cafeteria next week, if I remember right, or the week after. I just got it yesterday. So we'll have an opportunity to meet with that committee, and perhaps that will be a legislative directive that comes out of that. And I'd certainly even amend this bill to delete everything to do that. But I think we need one vehicle alive and well at this point down in a finance committee to do that. And, you know, we can have the discussion amongst ourselves. I would love to direct our statewide committee to do exactly that, to go out and canvass, see what's working, what isn't, what their suggestions may be, which would be the people we represent, too.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I sit here long enough, I think of more questions.
Dr. Casey, what is the average increase, percent increase in special salaries after the regionalization? Do you have any idea?
Dr. Casey.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, the university is under a hiring freeze. I'm sorry, not a hiring freeze, a salary freeze. So there were no salary increases for the 2000 fiscal year, which we're in right now.
Okay.
Representative Pennis.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to say that behind all this, I have a little trouble in my stomach just for lack of trust. Because I recall probably it had to be 2 or 3 years ago when we faced the same dilemma and inadvertently caught an email which proved to be very embarrassing for some of the university members. And, you know, this has been ongoing. And I think it could have happened and we could have lived with it had we known about it along the way. But getting the calls and answering for something we didn't do, Lord knows we do enough wrong and make enough decisions wrong to start with, but then we live with other people who we furnish with money to make decisions wrong we have to answer for. And so I don't know if Representative Junkie has any of that grit that I do, but that lies behind it a little bit. And so I would like to keep your bill alive.
Thank you, Dr. Casey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Jim Mulder from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Mulder. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties. This morning, our Legislative Steering Committee met and discussed this bill and made a decision. I should point out the Legislative Steering Committee is made up of 30 county officials, county commissioners, from across the state. We had, I think there were like 27 of them this morning. We discussed the bill and determined that we did not support the bill. We feel for, and if I can, I would just like to kind of describe the conversation just a little bit about why we came to that conclusion. First, we certainly appreciate, I think, the work that Representative Yonke has gone into and other legislators regarding this issue. But also, as we had the discussion this morning, we believe that the discussion needs to revolve around the value of the services and what the services are, and not about the structures. One of the things that I think is very important to counties is that there is no cookie-cutter approach that fixes this. If you happen to be in Hennepin County, the kind of extension service that you may want will be very different than the kind of extension service that you may have in Kitson County, or in Candy or High County, or in Houston County. And I think what the commissioners, as we talked about, is that, the second big piece of what they decided is they really wanted the flexibility. Now, I know there have been a number of questions regarding budgets. When we testified as an association last year, as we looked at the budget changes that were happening to county government, and we were asked by the legislature to do more with less. Well, the less is those things that weren't mandated upon counties. And those things that we discussed and I testified to were things like Minnesota Extension. They were like historical societies. They were like libraries. There was a whole long list of services that we discussed with legislators about these are the kinds of things that when we choose between providing services to children or daycare services or all of the other services that counties provide as mandated services, these are the things that we can't afford. In total, we had reductions in county support for counties. It was over $100 million of direct aid cuts, and our estimate is about another $250 million of shifts and new costs that were put on counties. Under levy limits, we were able to levy back approximately $80 million under levy limits. Well, that meant you had to find $200 and some million of savings someplace. And as we looked at these very, very difficult decisions, it was never a question of whether we thought extension is a good thing or a bad thing. It became a question of what can we afford to pay for, what we must pay for, what are we mandated to pay for, and one of those things that maybe we can do something else. What our county commissioners talked about this morning is because of the flexibility that we're now given, and I should point out within the budget process, we had already started having discussions with extension from a number of counties that said, you need to be aware that if we move forward and if we get the kind of cuts that are being suggested here, we are in all likelihood going to eliminate extension for everything other than 4-H. And that the opportunity to do the other services, the opportunity to provide, was just not going to be there. And these were in large pieces of the state, not just individual counties, but these were in large pieces of the state. These were serious discussions. They were discussions that were held with Dean Casey. They were discussions that were held at our association. Ultimately, counties cut somewhere between $4 and $5 million from extension services, from the support for extension services. Some of those cuts were in direct hard costs. Some of those are in soft costs, in space and telephones and stuff like that. So it was a very, very difficult decision. The third issue, I think, that our members talked about this morning was the issue about that whatever exists today, we understand that this is going to be a dynamic process. Whatever we put in place today, we suspect as issues change, as people whatever, is that it is going to be continuing to evolve as we try to define what is the best level of service. What are the best services? What are the things that the people in our community want? We talked a lot about what's the menu of services that we believe that you need to be offered, and then choose from the menu. And unfortunately, you know, you can't have everything, and we would love to do that. But again, we also have the fiscal responsibilities that we're faced with and the fiscal realities that we're faced with. With that, I will be willing to certainly answer any questions that I can from the association.
Any questions of Mr. Mulder? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Mulder. First of all, my county of Meeker asked me to do everything possible that I could to get extension back in the counties. Secondly, last year $4 million was given in salaries from the counties. This year $11 million. Thirdly, what is the percentage breakdown last year between hard and soft costs from the counties for expenses?
Mr. Mulder.
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have all of those details. I do know that the total amount that is budgeted, and the challenge that we have is that how people budget for this in both hard costs and soft costs is not necessarily consistent across all 87 counties. If you look at it, it drops from about 15 to 11. The other thing that happened is that we were already, and you recall that you were already talking about the 60-40. Dean Casey talked about the fact that we had some counties actually that were at 19% of a cost of an educator. We had a number of counties, I think we had one county that was up at about 47%. So part of what we were trying to do is all bring all those things together. As far as kind of what the current cost is, I think the $11 million that you're referring to is also not just hard costs of salaries, but those are also, in addition, the soft costs like travel and all of those things.
Salaries.
It's just salaries. I don't think so. I think when we talk about the $73,000 or those numbers that you're given, and when I listened to the testimony the other day, there is the salary, but then in the past, when we paid 40% or 25% or 35% of an educator's salary, we paid all of the extra costs. We paid not the benefits, but we paid their travel, we paid lodging, we paid paper, we paid whatever it costs to support them. Currently, if you purchase one of the programs, and what the counties will tell you is they have none of the soft costs. So if somebody has to drive in and do a program, you don't pay the transportation, you won't pay the mileage. That's now picked up as part of that cost from the university. So when you buy, instead of, and I think one of the things our county commissioners have struggled with is, and I think it's something that's easy to get caught up on, particularly, is you have to not think about buying people anymore. Is that, and I think that's one of the things that many of our county commissioners like, not buying people anymore. We're not purchasing a person. We're purchasing a service. So if you purchase community development, if you purchase agriculture, if you're purchasing that service, not just the warm body that happens to be there. So I think that it's a challenge. I think it's going to change. It's going to continue to evolve. I absolutely know that we're going to continue to negotiate with the university about how to better serve counties. But at this point, we're not sure, and in fact, some of the final comments that were made prior to voting on whether we wanted to support this bill or not, were the issues of, is there were a lot, people have a lot of questions about what this would mean. What exactly does it mean as maintaining an office? Is it if it's the offices that we had in 2002, I suspect there's a whole lot of counties that would not support that at this point. A lot of counties couldn't afford to bring back three and four secretaries or two secretaries or one secretary. And so, I mean, you have a whole group of things and group of issues. I will point out that there were representatives actually from Meeker. There was a representative from Meeker County at the meeting this morning, and it was a unanimous vote.
Representative Erdahl.
On those 4 million versus 11 million figures that I relate, if I am wrong in that, I would apologize, but that came from a report sent me by the University of Minnesota Accounting Service.
Madam Chair, if I can get that information, I will forward that information of what, at least I have not ever seen those numbers.
Representative Johnson.
And Madam Chair, I'm certainly willing to work with the counties. Again, what you're seeing here is these discussions happening in a vacuum. That's what we're trying to get. That's why this bill needs to move along, so we bring some of these people. I mean, here's counties talking about a different thing, and the legislature's got different, and we both represent people out there. And for the record, Representative Erdahl, one of my county commissioners, was on the original county committee that worked with this change, and he quit the committee because he was so upset at what was going on. So you're right. There's a lot of county commissioners just because their legislative committee voted for it. We've had our differences before at the county, and we'll have them again. But we're willing to work with them. But, again, let's not do this in a vacuum. You know, you should have had Representative Erdahl or me or anyone on this committee sitting over there at your meeting with your legislative committee this morning. We could have had some dialogue and talked about what the bill meant rather than just coming in and saying, well, we're opposed to it at this point. Well, you know, we need to have better communications with everyone, university, legislature, citizens, counties, on down the line. And hopefully as this bill moves forward, we can have just that.
Is there any further discussion? Thank you, Mr. Mulder.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Jeff?
I'd renew my motion, Madam Chair, that 2272 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Higher Education Finance.
Is there any discussion? We'll proceed to vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
This hearing is adjourned.